birthday.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English. On today's program, you will hear stories from Brian Lynn and Katie Weaver. Jill Robbins answers a question from an English learner in Brazil. We close with part two of Paul's case. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
The World Health Organization has identified the first six African countries to receive the technology to produce mRNA vaccines. The nations will be Egypt, Kenya, Nigeria, Senegal, South Africa, and Tunisia. The WHO announcement came Friday during a meeting of European Union and African Union countries in Brussels, Belgium. mRNA is the technology that companies such as Pfizer-BioNTech and Moderna used to create their COVID-19 vaccines. But those companies have centered on commercial operations to make their vaccines widely available in most Western nations across the world. Pfizer-BioNTech and Moderna have chosen not to share their vaccine production technology with the WHO and its partners in an effort to get more vaccines to poorer countries. The six nations named Friday were chosen to build vaccine production centers that will aim to copy the mRNA technology. The WHO estimates that only 11% of the population in Africa is fully vaccinated, compared with a worldwide average of about 50%. A United Nations-backed effort known as COVAX to bring COVID-19 vaccines to lower-income countries has already missed numerous targets. So far, only about 10% of people in poorer countries have received at least one vaccine injection. WHO Secretary General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus told the Brussels meeting that although more than 10 billion COVID-19 shots have been given, much of the world remains unvaccinated. The tragedy, of course, is that billions of people are yet to benefit from these life-saving tools, Ghebreyesus said. Last June, the WHO chose a group of South African companies to run its worldwide mRNA hub. The hub is designed to lead efforts to develop mRNA vaccine technology for lower and middle-income nations. From that effort, South African company Afrigen Biologics said it was able to replicate Moderna's vaccine technology to produce its own version of the American company's COVID-19 shot. But the WHO has said the first approval of Afrigen's candidate vaccine may not come until 2024. The hub has already begun establishing mRNA vaccine manufacturing laboratories and is working to launch commercial production. Training involving the chosen countries is expected to begin next month. Earlier this week, German vaccine maker BioNTech announced plans to establish its own manufacturing centers in Africa. At an event at its production center in Marburg, Germany, the company presented a model of the kind of vaccine production center it plans to ship to Africa. The presentation was attended by Ghebreyesus and the presidents of Senegal, Ghana, and Rwanda. Each center will be made from a collection of shipping containers that can be put together upon arrival. The manufacturing centers will include all equipment needed for making the company's mRNA vaccine. BioNTech said the first manufacturing center is expected to be shipped to either Senegal or Rwanda in the second half of this year. The company says it aims to start production of up to 50 million vaccine shots per year within 12 months. Our goal is to enable mRNA production on all continents, BioNTech chief Uğur Şahin told the Associated Press. BioNTech said its employees would run the operations at first while the company trains local partners to take over the manufacturing process. I'm Brian Lynn.
A new show at the British Museum in London explores the mystery of Stonehenge, the famous ancient circle of stones in southern England. The huge stones are believed to have been put in place between 5,000 and 3,500 years ago. The purpose of the circle is still debated. Was Stonehenge meant as a sundial, a burial ground, a memorial, or something else? Neil Wilkin is the lead curator of the show called The World of Stonehenge. "We all feel we know Stonehenge," he said. "We visit as school children or bring our kids to see it, but often we don't know much or feel like we don't know much about the world, the people who built the monument, and who came to worship at the monument." The World of Stonehenge exhibition brings together more than 430 objects from across Europe to explore the monument's creators and their world. It was a time of radical change that saw technological developments, major migrations, and social change. The people who built the first part of Stonehenge, with stones moved 250 kilometers from Wales, were followed by Bronze Age farmers, traders, and warriors who were connected to continental Europe. At first, Stonehenge was a cemetery. It holds the burned remains of up to 200 men, women, and children. Wilkin said, "People often ask, is it like the pyramids? But there's no pharaoh in the middle of this monument." Later, the first blue stones were placed in a ring of 4 meter tall standing stones with lintels across their tops. Much of that structure still stands. Wilkin said the monument became a place for honoring ancestors and for ceremonies. One of the very first objects visitors to the show see is an ancient cup shaped to look like Stonehenge. It's almost like a prehistoric souvenir, said project curator Jennifer Wexler. There are many other interesting images in the exhibition, from a wall covered in Neolithic stone-cutting tools to finely made gold hats and jewelry. Stonehenge was not the only circular henge monument built in ancient Britain. The British Museum show also looks at Seahenge, a circle of wood posts put up 4,000 years ago. The structure was uncovered by the waves on an English beach in 1998. Like Stonehenge, it is believed to have been lined up with the sun, which was central to the lives and beliefs of these ancient people. Experts say Stonehenge is lined up with sunrise and sunset, respectively, at the summer and winter solstices. Those are the days with the most and the least daylight of the year. The show's starring piece is a 3,600-year-old Nebra sky desk, a bronze circle with gold signs representing the sun, moon, and stars. It is believed to be the oldest surviving map of the sky. The disk was found in 1999 in eastern Germany, but the gold comes from Cornwall in southwest England. There is a really large amount of mobility and migration at this time, Wilkins said. In time, that mobility pushed out the Stone Age culture that built Stonehenge. Metalworking immigrants from Europe brought social and technological change. Metal meant people could carry important symbols with them, lessening the need for stone monuments like Stonehenge. Wilkins said the show aims to demonstrate the human side of the change from the Neolithic era to the Bronze Age. I'm Katie Weaver.
Hello. This week on Ask a Teacher, we answer a question from Orlando in Brazil. He writes, could you please tell me the difference between these phrases when talking about directions? We can turn left to go there, and we can make left to go there. Which one is considered correct? Thanks, Orlando, Brazil. Dear Orlando, thank you for writing to us. Please note that the word left serves as two different parts of speech in these two sentences. In the first one, left is an adverb. It shows the direction of a turn. Here is a similar example.
At the next intersection, I turned left and then right onto Main Street.
In that statement, both left and right show a movement in a certain direction. They are both adverbs, which means they affect the meaning of a verb. A person or a vehicle can turn, as we have in this example.
The car ran the stop right there, and it turned left.
But we would not talk about a vehicle making a turn. Generally speaking, only people can make a turn. Your second statement is missing an important word, the determiner A. It should be,
we can make a left to go there.
It also leaves out a word that a listener understands but is not said, turn.
We can make a left turn to go there.
When we give directions with the word make, we have to use A because here, left serves as an adjective. It modifies the noun turn. Here are other examples from the Corpus of Contemporary American English, or COCA.
He made a left turn on a red light. Horns protested. Officials said the driver in front was waiting to make a left turn.
In looking at the results in COCA, I found that to make a turn is much less common than simply using the verb turn. Some writers think it is a North American way of speaking. There is one more way to give directions. You can ask someone to take a turn.
Take the second right turn after the bank.
What question do you have about American English? Send us an email at learningenglish@voanews.com. And that's Ask a Teacher. I'm Jill Robbins.
Today, we complete the story, Paul's Case. It was written by Willa Cather. Here is Kay Gallant with the story.
Paul was a student with a lot of problems. He hated school. He didn't like living with his family on Cordelia Street in the industrial city of Pittsburgh. Paul wanted to be surrounded by beautiful things. He loved his part-time job as an usher at the concert hall. He helped people find their seats before the concert. Then he could listen to the music and dream of exciting places. Paul also spent a lot of time at the local theater. He knew many of the actors who worked there. He used to do little jobs for them, and they would let him see plays for free. Paul had little time left for his studies, so he was always in trouble with his teachers. Finally, Paul's teachers complained again to his father. His father took him out of school and made him take a job in a large company. He would not let Paul go near the concert hall or the theater. Paul did not like his job as a messenger boy. He began to plan his escape. A few weeks later, Paul's boss, Mr. Denny, gave Paul a large amount of money to take to the bank. He told Paul to hurry because it was Friday afternoon. He said the bank would close soon and would not open again until Monday. At the bank, Paul took the money out of his pocket. It was $5,000. Paul put the money back in his coat pocket, and he walked out of the bank. He went to the train station and bought a one-way ticket for New York City. That afternoon, Paul left Pittsburgh forever. The train traveled slowly through a January snowstorm. The slow movement made Paul fall asleep. The train whistle blew just as the sun was coming up. Paul awoke, feeling dirty and uncomfortable. He quickly touched his coat pocket. The money was still there. It was not a dream. He really was on his way to New York City with $5,000 in his pocket. Finally, the train pulled into Central Station. Paul walked quickly out of the station and went immediately to an expensive clothing store for men. The salesman was very polite when he saw Paul's money. Paul bought two suits, several white silk shirts, some silk ties of different colors. Then he bought a black tuxedo suit for the theater, a warm winter coat, a red bathrobe, and the finest silk underclothes. He told the salesman he wanted to wear one of the new suits and the coat immediately. The salesman bowed and smiled. Paul then took a taxi to another shop where he bought several pairs of leather shoes and boots. Next, he went to the famous jewelry store, Tiffany's, and bought a tie pin and some brushes with silver handles. His last stop was a luggage store, where he had all his new clothes put into several expensive suitcases. It was a little before 1 o'clock in the afternoon when Paul arrived at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel. The doorman opened the hotel's glass doors for Paul, and the boy entered. The thick carpet under his feet had the colors of 1,000 jewels. The lights sparkled from crystal chandeliers. Paul told the hotel clerk he was from Washington, D.C. He said his mother and father were arriving in a few days from Europe. He explained he was going to wait for them at the hotel. In his dreams, Paul had planned this trip to New York 100 times. He knew all about the Waldorf Astoria, one of New York's most expensive hotels. As soon as he entered his rooms, he saw that everything was perfect, except for one thing. He rang the bell and asked for fresh flowers to be sent quickly to his rooms. When the flowers came, Paul put them in water, and then he took a long, hot bath. He came out of the bathroom wearing the red silk bathrobe. Outside his windows, the snow was falling so fast that he could not see across the street. But inside, the air was warm and sweet. He lay down on the sofa in his sitting room. It had all been so very simple, he thought. When they had shut him out of the theater and the concert hall, Paul knew he had to leave. But he was surprised that he had not been afraid to go. He could not remember a time when he had not been afraid of something, even when he was a little boy. But now he felt free. He wasn't afraid anymore. He watched the snow until he fell asleep. It was 4 o'clock in the afternoon when Paul woke up. He spent nearly an hour getting dressed. He looked at himself often in the mirror. His dark blue suit fit him so well that he did not seem too thin. The white silk shirt and the blue and lilac tie felt cool and smooth under his fingers. He was exactly the kind of boy he had always wanted to be. Paul put on his new winter coat and went downstairs. He got into a taxi and told the driver to take him for a ride along Fifth Avenue. Paul stared at the expensive stores. As the taxi stopped for a red light, Paul noticed a flower shop. Through the window, he could see all kinds of flowers. Paul thought the violets, roses, and lilies of the valley looked even more lovely because they were blooming in the middle of winter. Paul began to feel hungry, so he asked the taxi driver to take him back to the hotel. As he entered the dining room, the music of the hotel orchestra floated up to greet him. He sat at a table near a window. The fresh flowers, the white tablecloth and the colored wine glasses pleased Paul's eyes. The soft music, the low voices of the people around him, and the soft popping of champagne corks whispered into Paul's ears. "This is what everyone wants," he thought. He could not believe he had ever lived in Pittsburgh on Cordelia Street. That belonged to another time and place. Paul lifted the crystal glass of champagne and drank the cold, precious, bubbling wine. He belonged here. Later that evening, Paul put on his black tuxedo and went to the opera. He felt perfectly at ease. He had only to look at his tuxedo to know he belonged with all the other beautiful people in the opera house. He didn't talk to anyone, but his eyes recorded everything. Paul's golden days went by without a shadow. He made each one as perfect as he could. On the eighth day after his arrival in New York, he found a report in the newspaper about his crime. It said that his father had paid the company the $5,000 that Paul had stolen. It said Paul had been seen in a New York hotel. And it said Paul's father was in New York. He was looking for Paul to bring him back to Pittsburgh. Paul's knees became weak. He sat down in a chair and put his head in his hands. The dream was ended. He had to go back to Cordelia Street, back to the yellow-papered bedroom, the smell of cooked cabbage, the daily ride to work on the crowded streetcars. Paul poured himself a glass of champagne and drank it quickly. He poured another glass and drank that one too. Paul had a taxi take him out of the city and into the country. The taxi left him near some railroad tracks. Paul suddenly remembered all the flowers he had seen in a shop window his first night in New York. He realized that by now, every one of those flowers was dead. They had had only one splendid moment to challenge winter. A train whistle broke into Paul's thoughts. He watched as the train grew bigger and bigger. As it came closer, Paul's body shook. His lips wore a frightened smile. Paul looked nervously around as if someone might be watching him. When the right moment came, Paul jumped. And as he jumped, he realized his great mistake. The blue of the ocean and the yellow of the desert flashed through his brain. He had not seen them yet. There was so much he had not seen. Paul felt something hit his chest. He felt his body fly through the air far and fast. Then everything turned black, and Paul dropped back into the great design of things.
You have just heard the American story, Paul's Case. It was written by Willa Cather. Your storyteller was Kay Gallant.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.